Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. If there's a mole in the ground, then I'd root the mountains down. Oh, I wish there's a mole in the ground. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. Oh, I wish there's Giannata sunglasses. If I's not his sunglasses, then I'd show you messages hiding before your very eyes.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I will be your host for the next hour. Every Monday morning, the Moles bring our listeners a variety of views, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonialist perspective. Nearly 2 weeks have passed since the election, and Trump's efforts to keep the presidency are failing at every level. Trumpism, however, promises to be with us for some time to come. Today on The Mole, we take a look forward at the work we must do in order to reunite a dangerously divided nation and build toward the just and equal society that the majority of us want. The challenges are enormous and will require even more on-the-ground organizing like that which was successful in defeating Trump. Later on in the show, we will hear from Desiree Hellegers, who speaks with former postal worker Jamie Partridge about what must be done to save the post office and the key role that postal workers played in defending the integrity of the election. Luisa Herrera will be talking with Cuban solidarity activist Tom Wojak about renewed efforts to end the U.S.-Cuban embargo and the benefits this could bring to both countries. We'll spice our show with music selections from contemporary Cuba. To begin our show this morning, Bill Resnick speaks with David Dayan, the editor of The American Prospect, a bimonthly magazine on U.S. politics. They discuss the many opportunities President-elect Biden will have through executive privilege to circumvent a Republican-controlled Senate and the fiscal hawks of his own Democratic Party in order to put progressive measures in place. These could include, as examples, a civilian public health corps to test and track viruses, halting foreclosures, facilitating model zero-carbon cities, forcing law enforcement to track and prosecute violent neo-fascists, and much, much more. None of this will happen, however, in the absence of sustained pressure from the grassroots.
Hello, David Dayan. Welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
David Dayan, it appears that Trump has been defeated this time around. It seems very probable that Joseph Biden will be sworn in as president. With his administration, the country, and all of us facing multiple crises, the pandemic, deep and what will be continued, economic troubles, recession, depression, vast numbers of people unable to pay the rent or mortgage, crisis of racism, and of course, global warming, greenhouse gas emissions, and more. Maybe the worst of it, there's an obstructionist U.S. Senate who think that if they can hobble and destroy Biden, then they can take power in 2 or 4 years, but under a much smoother right-wing president. And even more on top of that, many of the Democrats in the Congress are quite conservative deficit hawks. All that said, you and your colleagues at the American Prospect, a bimonthly magazine on U.S. politics, you've studied and written about how the U.S. president has great powers and could accomplish a great deal and might, in fact, be able to sufficiently deal with the crisis to stave off the right wing and their increasingly reactionary politics. So, David Dayan, give us a general sense of the powers of the president, and then we can talk about how the Biden administration might deal with some of the challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at Article 2 of the Constitution, you'll find that in addition to being Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces and able to negotiate treaties and staff his executive branch, the primary function of a president is to, and I quote, take care that the laws are faithfully executed. So Congress passes laws and the executive branch and the president implements them. And that's really the main function. It turns out that over a 230-plus year period, we've passed a good number of laws in the United States, and there is ample opportunity to implement those in ways that tangibly benefit the American people. In some cases, those methods of implementation have been clear for some time, and usually when a new administration comes in, they change the interpretation and they implement in their own way. In other cases, there are laws on the books that really haven't been used to their fullest potential in some time, and they have real opportunity there. So, for example, the Higher Education Act, which created the student loan program, gives the Secretary of Education the discretion to cancel that student debt at their will using something called compromise and settlement authority. So this would be absolutely very powerful to be able to reduce the burdens of student debt, which is a lead weight on our economy, and would really help a certain class of Americans who are so burdened that they can't buy homes or cars or participate in the economy in a meaningful way. Another one is through a system known as eminent domain for patents. The Health and Human Services Department can essentially seize a prescription drug patent and distribute it to a generic manufacturer who agrees to sell them at a reasonable cost. This would have a real effect of dramatically reducing prescription drug prices, and that's something that affects not just seniors, although they're affected most powerfully, but really everybody in the country. And so those are just two examples of things that sometimes have been overlooked, and other times have been used occasionally to make progress for the public. And ultimately, I think if Joe Biden's going to be successful, he's going to have to show the progress that he's making for people. He's going to have to make it manifest in their lives. And these are two ways to do that, and we have a whole bunch more at our Day One Agenda site at prospect.org.
You know, another thing, of course, is just to change the priorities of the agencies. The Department of Justice could stop running after voting fraud, which they're being urged to do now by Trump. They could, in fact, be taking action against racist voter suppression, of voter intimidation, of supporting Black Lives Matter, the Black Lives Matter struggle, by trying to control the police and force cities and states to actually do something. In the Energy Department, they control how many billions of dollars, maybe $20 or $40 billion of grants, maybe more, depending on their nuclear weapon programs. But they could make a start in creating a clean energy economy, certainly in 4 years. Good start, much more than we've done up to now.
Right. There are so many ways that a president can really affect the trajectory of the economy. We've seen it with Donald Trump, right? I mean, Donald Trump has really only passed one substantial law in his 4 years, and that was the Trump tax cuts. But he made tremendous transformation in all kinds of other areas of domestic and foreign policy, and he did it using the executive authority of the presidency of the United States. And Joe Biden can do the same thing. I mean, presidents make all kinds of regulatory decisions, like who qualifies for overtime pay. They can decide whether or not a worker is misclassified as an independent contractor or whether they're an actual employee entitled to benefits. They can choose whether corporations continue to be allowed to do stock buybacks, which is a situation where they leak out bunch of value to investors rather than keeping it in the hands of workers. there are so many things, immigration policy and foreign policy and trade policy, where presidents control really the entire apparatus, all kinds of environmental regulation, healthcare regulations, financial regulations, where there's a really free hand because Dodd-Frank gives a whole bunch of opportunities there. Corporate power and antitrust. You talk about the Justice Department and their posture. The Justice Department can go after big corporations who are using their power to engage in anti-competitive conduct. They can go after white-collar crime rather than, you know, nonviolent criminal offenders like drug possession. A president can legalize marijuana, for example, by descheduling it from the list of controlled substances. All of this, I should say, is based on already passed laws by Congress. This is not like a dictatorship. This is Congress wrote the laws and the president can implement them. Over the last several presidencies, we've seen Republican presidents really maximize that implementation, and Trump is one example of that, and Democratic presidents kind of shy away from this power that they have the ability to use. So what I'm saying is that Joe Biden needs to act like he has the power he actually has and use that to make progress.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to David Dayen. He's the executive editor of the American Prospect. He's published several books. He's the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud, won the Studs and Ida Turkle Prize. He blogs almost daily on the politics of this country. He's written hundreds of articles. We've been discussing the power of the president with or without congressional support. Dave, tell us about what could be done about the pandemic and the recession without the Senate, in fact, approving it.
Sure. So the pandemic obviously is going to be the key area of focus at the beginning of the administration. The Biden transition has already set up a task force of doctors, people in the scientific community who will give him recommendations for what to do. He's talked about certain things, including building a public health jobs corps, which might be able to be done out of existing appropriations, a force of people to do contact tracing and things like that. He can use the Defense Production Act to ensure that we have the PPE as well as any kind of drug therapies that we need. What the Defense Production Act does is it informs manufacturers that they have to work on this first. And, you know, they're paid for their work, but it prioritizes production of critical needs for the United States. Those are things that can be done. There are other things like pressuring states to engage in mask mandates and things like that. The biggest thing is going to be dealing with the potential vaccine. So Pfizer came out this week and said that they've seen very good results in preliminary trials of their vaccine. We expect that by the end of the year, Pfizer and maybe other drug manufacturers that are working on this will get emergency use authorization from the Food and Drug Administration. But then the work begins, because what you're talking about is a logistical project that has heretofore been unknown in mankind, really. You're talking about distributing this vaccine to every man, woman, and child in the United States who wants it. You're talking about hundreds of millions of people. It's a two-dose process, so you got to keep track of who got the first dose and make sure they come back for the second dose. It's an absolute logistical bear. I mean, you're talking about getting this stuff from facilities, has to be kept in super cold conditions, has to be distributed to every corner of the United States. We have to figure out how much of the vaccine we're going to have at first, whether it has to be rationed to vulnerable communities and healthcare frontline workers, and make sure that gets distributed, finding the people to administer the vaccine, public health professionals, finding which facilities are going to distribute this. Is it going to be at pharmacies or clinics or pop-up sites, mobile sites, finding the personnel to do that, making sure they're doing it safely, because we're in the middle of a pandemic that is highly contagious. So distributing this vaccine becomes perilous in and of itself. All of those things are going to have to be done in sort of a top-down way, in a fashion where the federal government is incredibly involved in the coordination and the logistics.
Yeah, some of it has to be a top-down way to get all the availability and the money. On the other hand, the American system has great strengths in that every county in this country, some of them depopulated, maybe one person doing it half-time, but they have a health department, and the states all do. Like Multnomah County, I could imagine if they were given the resources to do it, they could establish a distribution program as well as a culture of you've got to take this vaccine and overcome the anti-vaxxers, another problem.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that there are county health officials that are going to be very involved in this, state-level health officials that are going to be very involved. But ultimately, there is going to be a need for a real tracking of this distribution. The vaccine cannot be left on the shelf for more than a couple of days. It has a very short shelf life. Once you distribute it, you got to make sure it's used. And that tracking is going to be absolutely critical. The way it's been explained to me is that the federal government will distribute portions of the vaccine to the states and counties, and then it will be responsible for the states and counties to get it into the arms of as many patients as
right.
need it. It's a coordinated response. It's a state-federal coordinated response.
Let's talk about the economy, David. We have to somehow make sure that the homeless rate doesn't go up by 10 or 100 times to be absolutely overwhelming for cities. And we have to get money and food into the hands of people who need it. It's going to be a quite large population. And furthermore, a lot of companies are going to go under. They're productive assets for the country in capitalist hands. And if they don't show profits over time, they go under. The unemployment will remain quite large. People will be hurting. And it will be very, very difficult to make a city that's governable, especially under the conditions of the pandemic. No vaccine is going to be perfect. We're banking on one of them being long-term and successful. Even if it's fairly successful, the economy is going to be in deep trouble. What can be done about that?
The economy is certainly as high, if not higher, of a priority than the public health emergency that we have. We have really a twin emergency going on right now. Some of it's masked by the fact that we have so much inequality in this country, but it's grown worse during the pandemic, and there are millions of people that are really on the edge right now. We did not get a second stimulus package before the election. Mitch McConnell is now talking about doing one in the lame duck session before Biden takes office. His vision of that is very small and very targeted, and there's a pretty wide gap between what McConnell is willing to do and what the House leadership wants in terms of a much bigger bill. The control of the Senate is going to be the real determination here. We're down to two special elections in Georgia being determinative of control of the U.S. Senate. We're either going to get Mitch McConnell continuing to be in control, or at best a 50-50 Senate where Kamala Harris as vice president gets to be the tiebreaker. Either way is not the greatest of circumstances, but you could see Democrats saying that if we win the Senate races in Georgia, this is what we're going to provide in terms of stimulus. And to actually list it out and make that Georgia Senate runoff for those two seats a referendum on the type of economic relief that people can get, and really make it a definitive question. You vote for this person and this is what you get. I think that would be the best course of action. It would go a long way to determining where we're going to be economically in the future. Now, we had back in March the CARES Act, which did distribute a good deal of relief to people in terms of extended unemployment benefits and a one-time stimulus check. But that money is gone now. And many of the programs that were associated with the CARES Act have expired, and many more will at the end of the year, including the moratorium on evictions, as well as a couple of the unemployment programs. So it's vital that we get something in place, whether it's before the end of the year or after. It's absolutely critical because we're going to see poverty shoot up. We're going to see homelessness, everything that you said. That just is going to require a ton of pressure on the people in Washington, particularly in the Senate, to make sure they do right by the American people. They are completely abandoning them right now.
Is it possible that some Republicans would buck McConnell and move towards a major stimulus? On the other hand, there's the, quote, moderate deficit hawk Democrats who could also break with the party.
Yeah, it's unclear. Certainly what McConnell has said is that there are a number of people in his caucus who are not interested in any stimulus whatsoever. And of course, after the election, we saw a couple folks who might have been willing to go along with some form of stimulus lose. That would be Cory Gardner in Colorado and Martha McSally in Arizona. It's really unclear. There is sort of that little group of Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and Mitt Romney potentially, although I'm not sure about Romney, that might be willing, but there are a number that would be unwilling to allow it to go through. And of course, regular course of legislation, it would need 60 votes if somebody filibusters. And you can bet that someone like a Rand Paul or folks who are trying to rev up for 2024 as deficit hawks would be very interested in filibustering. So this might need a lot of votes.
It seems to me that what we've talked about is both ominous, but there's tremendous opportunity. And then there's climate change hovering in the background. But there's also the Green New Deal. Radical forms could, with sufficient appropriations, unemployment crisis and the economic crisis could be solved by moving towards a green ecosystem restoring economy, but it would require massive rallies and demonstrations pushing in every direction.
Yeah, and politics is often a time of promise and peril. It's an endless fight. Nothing's ever over. You think you have vanquished Donald Trump, but you really haven't defeated Trumpism, and that still is alive and well in segments of the Republican Party. There is no moment where you can exhale and just walk off the field. The party that figures out how to benefit the American people in a way that they can see and touch and feel is going to be the party that succeeds. And Democrats and Republicans, really neither of them, have figured out how to do that over the course of the last several election cycles. And so we've seen these wild swings back and forth. Obviously, the situation calls for a grassroots movement to really push politicians in the direction of providing that relief. And it would be in their political self-interest to do so as well. So there are signs that Biden understands this to a certain extent, that we have to, in his words, build back better. But there are signs that are more troubling. And politics always has both of those things in hand. There's promise and there's peril. So we got to keep watching and agitating and make sure that we get to a good place.
David Dayan, thanks for talking to us. Keep up the good work at the American Prospect.
All right. Thank you.
That was Bill Resnick speaking with David Dayan from the American Prospect about opportunities President-elect Biden will have to implement progressive programs. Next on our show, Luisa Herrera talks with socialist activist Tom Wojak about a recently released statement by the Democratic Socialists of America denouncing the U.S.-Cuba embargo. They argue that it's past time to end the inhumane economic sanctions and normalize relations so that U.S. citizens can judge for themselves the successes or the unmet challenges of organizing a society in a very different way. By way of introduction to this segment, we're going to play a clip from the original song about Che Guevara called Hasta Siempre, or Until Forever, by Cuban revolutionary singer and songwriter Carlos Puebla.
Aprendimos muerte.
Aquí se queda la clara, la entrañable transparencia de tu querida presencia, comandante Che Guevara.
My name is Luisa, and I am talking today with socialist activist Tom Wojak about a recently released statement he authored by the Democratic Socialists of America. Some of the demands listed in the statement are: the United States government must nullify all economic sanctions against the Republic of Cuba. The U.S. government and its allies must immediately cease all operations of espionage, coercion, and propaganda meant to destabilize the Republic of Cuba. The U.S. must permanently suspend all operations in Guantanamo Bay, Gitmo Bay, withdraw all personnel, and cede all territory back to the Republic of Cuba. The government must permit the free travel between the Republic of Cuba and the United States. And the U.S. government should request medical assistance from Cuban medical brigades, encourage medical collaboration with Cuban doctors and researchers, and permit the import of Cuban pharmaceuticals. Tom Wojak of Chicagoland is a member of the DSA, a member of the DSA International Committee, and co-chair of the America's Working Group under the IC. He is the author of the Cuba Solidarity Resolution, which passed at the 2019 National Convention, and the national liaison between DSA and the National Network on Cuba. Hi, Tom.
Hi, very happy to be here today.
So just starting off, what is the National Network on Cuba?
The National Network on Cuba is an umbrella organization of American organizations that are seeking to end the embargo against Cuba and also to promote friendship between the peoples of the United States and the peoples of Cuba.
And what sparked your interest in Cuba solidarity organizing?
Well, initially, I had attended one of the international Mayday brigades. I had never, ever been to a place that was outside the sphere of American influence. And as a very young socialist at the time, it was extremely rewarding to just see that a different world could be organized. I think under capitalism, you're taught and it's trained into your head that there's only one type of world that can possibly be organized. While I was there, I was able to talk with so many people from Cuba. I was able to listen to some of the great successes they've had and also some of the great calamities that the embargo has caused the Cuban people. And it gave me a much more complete portrait of life on the island, which I have carried with me through all my Cuba solidarity organizing.
Could you give a brief history and explanation of the embargo, sometimes referred to as the Helms-Burton Act, and maybe the UN response to it?
Cuba has been the victim of the longest running embargo in world history, which is imposed on it by the U.S. government and its allies. It is meant to be a huge impediment for conducting trade and conducting commerce, and is basically meant as a huge amount of pressure on Cuban life. And it is one of the, if not the, central concern of the Cuban people. And it's been a huge calamity in many ways, in some small, some very, very large. The American embargo sanctions affect the importing of small consumer goods or the staying at Cuban hotels. But in a much larger way, it prohibits Cubans from visiting their family members. It greatly limits what Cubans are allowed to bring into the country, including necessary supplies that would be incredibly helpful to their infrastructure. And that is basically the design of the embargo. Helms-Burton is one of the big ones, but that's not the only one. I would invite people to look into some of the other sanctions. But basically, the purpose is the same: to stop Cuban socialism on the island by targeting the Cuban people. It's inhumane. And the UN has actually voted for, 28 consecutive years overwhelmingly to condemn the American embargo on Cuba, but obviously due to the privileged position of the United States within the UN, not a lot has resulted from that. But most governments reject the American embargo as a fundamental violation of human rights and human dignity, and this sort of work that I hope that the DSA will be doing. And I hope that other organizations in America on the left and otherwise will take more seriously.
Then what would lifting the embargo mean for Cuba and the Cuban people?
It's funny, you know, we're not even talking about planting a Cuban flag in Washington, D.C. I think the point of the Cuban solidarity movement isn't to give Cuba some sort of special status in the world community. We're simply insisting that Cuba be treated like a normal country. And we're fighting for the normalization of Cuba in the eyes of America in order to for Cuba to realize its, you know, autonomy, which so far has been greatly hindered by United States embargoes. So, for instance, one of the things that Cubans have been calling for is the ability to trade with the United States, which is the makes a lot of sense. It's one of the closest countries to them, 80 miles off the shore. It has products that the United States would benefit from. I think culturally, even there would be a much more vibrant exchange of information and ideas, which is one of the other things that the embargo is designed to do, to limit contact between the Cuban people and the American people, to make sure that we don't get to see Cuba. We don't get to talk to the Cuban people or listen to what they want. I think that the American government very fundamentally wants Cubans to be aliens in a lot of way, because it's a lot easier to persecute the Cuban people if sanctions were lifted and our relationship became more normalized. I think that Americans would be able to see Cuba for what it is, which is a wonderful, vibrant place full of wonderful, vibrant people.
So aside from kind of the rich cultural contributions that Cuba has to offer, one of the programs that they've had for quite some time are the Cuban medical brigades. Could you talk a little bit about the brigades?
Yes. Cuba has been internationally lauded for sending its medical personnel abroad. It's done this since the days of the, you know, the early days of the revolution. The Cuban doctors were sent to Angola. Cuban doctors were sent to South Africa. Cuban doctors, until very recently, were doing work in Brazil. And basically, this medical humanitarianism has been one of the cornerstones of Cuban foreign policy. Even in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, Cuba had offered to send medical personnel and assistance to the United States to help, you know, with all the emergencies that were happening in New Orleans. But this overture was rejected by the administration at the time. Cuban medical brigades should be absolutely commended for their work. They go into places where no one else goes. They have been recognized even recently with the COVID epidemic for going into countries like Italy and providing assistance. Similarly, the American people would greatly benefit from such programs and cooperation. Another dimension of it is that the Cuban biotechnological industry has been producing many medicines and treatments that in most cases, Americans are not allowed to access. And I believe that the future is medical cooperation with Cuba, again, as if it were a normal country.
So shifting gears just a little bit, I know you visited Cuba as part of your solidarity work. And so could you talk about your personal experience kind of interacting with the Cuban Socialist Project?
I think as a young socialist, when I first went to Cuba, I had a lot of these preconceived notions of Cuba that are very, very popular with the United States State Department, that it's somehow this lifeless communist hell, that it's that people are always just frowning and people are always just, you know, a Cold War caricature. And very immediately, anyone who's ever been to Cuba will know that that is just the absolute antithesis of what it actually is, that there's so much life and so much vibrance to the Cuban people who are operating, I think, quite admirably, even in spite of these enormous sanctions. I met with many Cubans, many of whom were extraordinarily enthusiastic of the socialist project that was on the island. But I think also more telling, I met Cubans who were not enthusiastic and were able to make that opinion known. It's not just this overreaching police state. It's not this cultural or ideological monolith. It's not like, again, the Cold War caricature. People are just being held, you know, politically hostage by their government. It's not just this monolithic people. And I think people would be very surprised, because that flies directly into the myth that I think the United States government has been perpetrating about socialism and other socialist projects. One of the most valuable things that Cuba provides in terms of fostering a greater political imagination for people is understanding what it is to actually have living, breathing socialism. Because formerly, before I went to Cuba, I was just, you know, I just ran a Marxist reading group. I didn't know socialists that occupied great seats of power. And when I went to Cuba, I started to meet socialists who ran factories, or socialists who, you know, were appointed to run libraries, or doctors who were socialists. And I think that greatly expanded my imagination for what was possible. Basically, again, all that the Cuba Solidarity Movement is asking is that people be able to go and see for themselves what Cuba actually is. The Cuban people and the American people have so much in common, have so much to share with each other. And the Cuba Solidarity Organizing Movement is only seeking to build that.
The notion that relations with Cuba be normalized is such a controversy in places like where I'm from. I grew up in South Florida and similar political circles. And so if we had to blame, you know, who could we kind of identify as being part of the cause for the continued embargo? Is it the Cuban expat community that has such a strong voice in Florida?
Well, first of all, I am always very, very reluctant to just write off the Cuban expat community as if it were still, you know, the 1960s. I think that the first wave of people that left Cuba were obviously the people who were ousted by the Cuban Revolution, the capitalists, the landowners, the very, very wealthy that opposed the redistribution policies of Fidel Castro. But as history progressed, I think that there have been a great multitude of people that come to the United States for various reasons. I think in a lot of way, life has been made very difficult by the U.S. sanctions. And, you know, if people are moving from Cuba to the United States, who can blame them, right? All we want is a better life. And so I'm always very, very reluctant to just universally blame Cuban Americans. That said, I think that there is a hyper reactionary portion of Cuban Americans that are being enabled fundamentally by the U.S. government. Very recently, we saw the absurdity of the U.S. government hosting a medal or some sort of ceremony celebrating the failed Bay of Pigs operation. So I think that as that generation is slowly phasing out, a new generation is taking its place. So for instance, young Cuban Americans are often just as susceptible to democratic socialism or socialism as are any other population of young people. And so I think that paper tiger of the Miami reactionary is being given a very outsized role in American politics, intentionally so, but also I think that it's slowly receding. I think there's a lot of good evidence to suggest that sort of mentality is changing towards, at the very worst, apathy. You know, why are we against Cuba? Why are we imposing this seemingly absurd embargo on the Cuban people? And at best, a legitimate enthusiasm for improved relationships.
I might push back a little bit on that level of optimism, having been just virtue of my having lived in South Florida. I would say that socialist organizing in the Miami area, in and around Miami, and really Florida writ large, is very difficult because that perception kind of remains. And I do agree with you that it's a small population of expats that are driving the narrative, but they are a minority. They're a powerful minority, though, especially considering kind of the privileged nature of folks who moved to the United States. But, you know, I will say that there is more folks are on board with the idea of normalizing trade with Cuba. I was in Miami. I was working for a labor organization when Obama made the announcement that, you know, he planned to open up Cuba. And I worked with a lot of Cubans, Cuban Americans. You know, they either moved here when they were one or they were second gen, but they were generally on board. And their perception was, yeah, it hasn't been working. So let's try something new. And so just if you could briefly talk about kind of President Obama's intentions to open up Cuba and what that meant.
Yeah. What's interesting with Cuba solidarity organizing is I think that there are actually a lot of people across the political spectrum that want to end the embargo, not just on the left, but surprisingly, also Democrats and even some Republicans. Not only is the embargo a moral crisis, it simply doesn't make sense. And so there are a lot of people trying to open embargo for various reasons. And I think that that presents an urgency to the left in voicing a respect for ending the embargo from the left. I think that we need to prioritize Cuban socialism. I think we need to prioritize Cuban autonomy. Obama, for instance, I think one of the issues that he really wanted to do was if he opened up Cuba to American companies, that he would be able to conquer Cuba with bankers, right? But the thing that he kind of encountered, at least as far as I understand it, was that the Cuban economy was not compatible with the sort of neoliberalism that he wanted to export, that in fact, the Cuban people insisted on socialism, and that was something that they were not willing to negotiate in the way that, you know, East Germany, for instance, during the fall of the Berlin Wall was willing to negotiate. And I'm hoping that in the future, the lesson that the left learns is that we need to present a viable alternative. We need to propose very specific, careful language in ending the Cuban embargo on Cuba's terms, rather than just trying to make it some, you know, additional neocolonial project, which the Cuban people have emphatically stated they are not interested in doing.
So lastly, how can people learn more about Cuba and Cuban socialism?
There are so many, obviously, academic works and documentaries. But actually, very recently, there has been this fantastic documentary series that was just released called Belly of the Beast, which can be found at bellyofthebeastcuba.com, which really tells the Cuban story from a very, very humanizing perspective. I would also highly encourage people to keep their ear to the ground for the DSA International Committee. I would also like to plug the National Network on Cuba, which is a very, very reliable source on all matters Cuba, and all information can be found at their website, nnoc.info.
Thanks so much for your time, Tom.
Thank you so very, very much. Very happy to be here, Luisa.
That was from a song extolling the virtues of Cuba called Me Dicen Cuba, roughly translated, They Call Me Cuba. The song is by Cuban trumpet player Alexander Abreu and his group Habana de Primera. Before that, we heard from Luisa Herrera and Tom Wojak about the pressing need to end the U.S.-Cuba embargo. To wrap up our show today, Desiree Hellegers talks with retired postal worker and labor organizer Jamie Partridge, who is also the co-host of KBOO's own Labor Radio. They discuss the role of U.S. postal workers in protecting the integrity of the 2020 election, about the key roles played by the Postal Service, and about Tuesday's National Day of Action to prevent the Postal Service from being dismantled and privatized.
So I'm speaking today with Jamie Partridge, who is a retired postal worker. He's a member of the Letter Carriers Union. He's a board member, an organizer with Jobs with Justice, and an organizer with Communities and Postal Workers United. And Jamie's an all-around mainstay of the Portland labor community. And we just talked to you, Jamie, back in August. So we understand that the ballots are still being counted right now. And I know you've got a rally coming up on Tuesday. So tell us, you know, what do we most need to know about the state of the post office? And do we have reason to believe that the Biden administration is going to try to undo a lot of the damage that the Trump administration under DeJoy has done?
Well, it's a lot to answer, and I'll jump right in. Postal workers really came through with this election. We delivered 65 million mail in ballots. We carried the highest voter turnout in 50 years, thanks to the safety afforded voters by vote by mail. And it wasn't easy. We were being blocked and harassed on every turn by the current administration that was trying to discredit and restrict vote by mail. And certainly we talked before about how the Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, who's a Trump crony and a mega donor to the Republican Party, delayed the mail significantly starting in July. And only through a public outcry and a congressional inquiry and a number of court injunctions was he forced to back off from his various methods of delaying the mail. However, there were still some kerfuffles and drama in getting all the ballots into boards of election on either on election day or within a few days after election day. Each state has a different regulation about how the vote-in mail-in ballots have to be in. But we worked overtime, massive overtime. We made sure that ballots got priority treatment. We performed special sweeps of the mail processing plants and special deliveries to the election boards. And even when postal management wasn't on top of it, postal workers would scour their stations for ballots and make sure on election day that the ballots got to the elections office. And this election is clearly won by Biden. And however, the Trump administration is refusing to concede and doing so on the basis of trying to discredit mail-in voting. And we'll see whether they're successful in doing that. We have till December 6th for the certification of the elections. And we'll see if Republican legislators bow to the pressure to discredit and disqualify the mail-in ballots in some of those swing states. Currently, we're having as you mentioned, a rally, a nationwide day of action called by the American Postal Workers Union on Tuesday, that's the 17th of November, here in Portland, 4 o'clock at the East Portland Post Office, which is 1020 Southeast 7th between Hawthorne and Belmont on 7th. And it's to appreciate and celebrate postal workers having delivered democracy, but also to get out the message that we now have to defend the Postal Service from all the cuts and closures and delay of mail and all these operational changes that Postmaster General DeJoy put in place and was forced to back off from. He's going right back on. And this guy he basically has free rein to contract out, do union busting, basically screw up the Postal Service with the purpose, which he's an ideological privatizer. He wants to degrade and dismantle the Postal Service in order to sell it off to Wall Street. This is, of course, the Trump administration's agenda, but it's been an agenda almost bipartisan of the business class for many years. And an incoming Biden administration could help, but if the Senate stays Republican, Biden can't do much because the Postmaster General is hired and fired by the Postal Board of Governors. Postal Board of Governors is appointed by the president, and there are three openings which could be appointed by Biden, and that would make a majority Democrats on the Postal Board of Governors and might you know, move in the direction of getting rid of this Postmaster General. However, the Senate leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, has basically indicated that he's not going to allow any progressive appointees, either to the Biden's cabinet or to the Postal Board of Governors or any of those institutions, you know, so that really it's only going to be public pressure and ramping up the pressure and the turning up the heat on Congress and the Senate to, in particular, to do the right thing. And the right thing not only is to get rid of the Postmaster General, but to provide the revenue that the Postal Service needs to survive the COVID, both all the expenses related to postal workers getting sick and, you know, being out on leave and forced to stay home because for childcare and all that, but also the revenue to the Postal Service has dropped because of the economic recession. And so the ask is for $25 billion COVID-related relief, and the House of Representatives has passed that bill called the HEROES Act, but the Senate has not moved on it. And, of course, Trump has indicated he would veto it. But even with a Biden presidency, if it doesn't move in the Senate, the Postal Service will run out of money next year.
And we talked earlier about the fact that this budget crisis within the post office, which, you know, the Republicans are always going on about, is itself a manufactured crisis, right, where they were basically forced to commit.
Well, it's basically 75 years in advance paying for retiree health benefits, which is basically 10% of the postal budget every year is put into the treasury, put away, which, you know, of course, it isn't sitting there. It gets spent, you know, it gets spent on the war in Afghanistan or wherever it gets spent. But anyway, the fact is that the Postal Service has been since the recession, you know, 2008, has been going into the hole because of this manufactured crisis. But even beyond that, we're talking about tremendous impact because of COVID, and all these other industries are being bailed out, you know, the airlines and the cruise ships and all these industries, you know, $500 billion to the other sectors, but the Postal Service is getting nothing. And of course, it's not just about ballots, which, you know, Trump was alleging that he if he kept money out of the hands of the Postal Service, he could prevent vote by mail. But it's actually some really important, you know, like prescription drugs, medical equipment that the Postal Service like delivers 1.2 billion prescription drugs a year, including all of Veterans Administration prescriptions. Of course, people who are sheltering at home, they have online shopping just for basic necessities. Postal Service delivers all those parcels. And of course, there's, you know, Social Security checks for seniors and lots of people who don't have internet connection to rely exclusively on the mail, especially in rural areas. Small businesses a lot do, you know, shipping by mail. All of this is critical to keeping our country connected. And this is why we're trying to engage people in getting involved with the struggle to save the Postal Service, not only to get the $25 billion emergency relief, but to permanently reverse these delays that DeJoy has implemented and is going to implement again. So we're encouraging people to, you know, get in touch with members of Congress, but also to show up at our rally on Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. And presumably there's a lot of awareness that the situation with the election would have looked very, very different if it had been a privatized business, if they were not good union jobs, the workers did not feel a strong sense of investment in their mission and their workplace.
Totally. Once you're in the postal family, you have have the kind of connections that we have with our customers. Once you're in, you're really in for life. I mean, I was in for 30 years, and, you know, I really got to know the people on my route and felt very invested in making sure that they got the best service. And that's, you know, by and large, true of all postal workers. And it was great what happened that as the election results started coming in, was crowds of people were spontaneously cheering postal workers, you know, as they, you know, drove by in their trucks or, you know, I saw this video of Philadelphia, the dance party outside the convention center where they were counting the ballots. People were dressed up as postal, the blue collection boxes, you know, and dancing in the street. So I think there is a love affair between American people and their postal service. And we've seen that people come out in the past, and we continue to need people to not only survive, but to improve and expand the Postal Service. I mean, we should have our post office should be open later hours. They should have postal banking. We should have one-stop government services at post offices. There's all kinds of ways that we can use the infrastructure that we have, the 35,000 post offices we have in every zip code.
There's no other governmental service that appears door to door like clockwork and is actually able to, in some ways, do wellness checks for people who are living in more isolation than any of us ever have been.
Yeah.
So that social support disappears without the post office.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jamie. Thanks for filling us in. And again, so that event is Tuesday
at 4 o'clock at East Portland Post Office, which is 1020 Southeast 7th between Hawthorne and Belmont on Southeast 7th.
Thank you. All right. And I've been talking to Jamie Bergenizer, retired postal worker. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Oldmole Variety Hour.
And that concludes our show for today. I would like to thank Mole's Bill Resnick, Luisa Herrera, and Desiree Helgers for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guests, David Dayan, Tom Wojak, and Jamie Partridge. Later on today, we'll post a downloadable podcast of today's show and its individual segments to the website at kboo.fm. We will also post links to additional material that might interest you. You can contact the Old Mole at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with your questions and comments. Please join us again next Monday morning for more commentary from the point of view of the 99% and a vision of a radically democratic world. We're going to leave you today with a song by the Cuban group Orishas called A Lo Cubano. Thanks for listening and stay safe.
¿Dónde están los de la nueva generación? Son y mira, ponte en el fuego de la acción. Compresión de la lírica, mística, psíquica. La rumba ha comenzado con Anga, Flaco Pro, el negro Yoruba, hijo de Guacandela. Escucha cómo suena, no hay más nada. Sonido fuerte, ardiente.